Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa. I titled this series of conversations with young people, The Love of Learning and the Desire for God. I met each person in this series while teaching at Newman Theological College in Edmonton from 2020, during the pandemic, through the fall of 2023. Newman had just introduced a new degree and moved its curriculum into a great books and Socratic dialogue model. I'm joined by Victor Carpe in this podcast. I never had the pleasure of having Victor in one of the classes I was privileged to teach. We talked periodically in the atrium of Newman, and I glimpsed how the study of the great books, the Socratic method, the Newman community, and the liturgical life were at work in nurturing his mind and heart. Victor is likely the most precocious businessman I have ever met. He also began engaging party politics as a young boy, an experience completely foreign to me. You will hear Victor speak about how his Newman education, his professors, Drs. Topping and Fast, initiated him to reading the great books, taught him to enter the author's mind, appreciate the questions and problems each author wrestled with. Each of these great books, whether it was the Iliad, Plato and Aristotle, Boethius and Aquinas, through to Nietzsche and Marx, have touched his mind and prepared him for engaging others, including those he may not immediately understand. The Socratic method, so finely taught at Newman, has reshaped his political understanding. As a young, passionate conservative, he has come to realize, as Aristotle taught, that friendship is central to the political life in a civil society. Once you can find something mutually cared for, and cared for across party lines, politics begins. Welcome to our conversation. One of the sadnesses I have, Victor, related to you,
okay,
is that you were never in a class that I had at Newman. But one of the pleasures related to you is that I used to run into you and talk with you in the foyer there at Newman. And I got a little sense from you and from your colleagues, the way they spoke about you and what you meant to them, that there were things going on in your mind and your heart. I also recall, and it's appropriate, I think, to begin with this. I also recall, perhaps correctly, perhaps not, you can fill this out. I recall, I think it was a year and a half ago, that in the break, you went to Rome. And when you came back from Rome, my memory is, when I chatted with you, that you had glimpsed something in Pope Francis, which had kind of shifted things for you a little bit. You saw things a little bit differently. And we're, of course, talking today on the day after the burial of Pope Francis, and a week, slight of a week, before he entered the eternal. And I was so delighted to hear that he had managed to go to prison on Holy Thursday, despite his ill health. And then, of course, on Pascha, on Sunday, was able to go into the and greet the people a bit and just offer the blessing that he gives. And then he goes home and he enters the eternal. So we think of him, and may his memory be eternal.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Well, when I went to Rome 2 years ago, it's amazing to think. It's a testament to Pope Francis's heart of service and character that he was there doing all of the Holy Week celebrations. Because when I went to Rome, it was in, it was in 2023 for Easter. And I spent 10 days there doing a paper presentation in a conference, a part of Opus Dei. And I remember when I first saw the Pope inside of the Vatican Square, It was difficult for him to stand up. He had trouble having a clear, strong voice because even then he had similar health issues. And yet, despite that, he hopped into the Pope Mobile after and did his rounds and was there and stood up for the people. So it was something where, you know, even, yeah, 2.5 years ago, he was still struggling with his health. And despite that, was just present at mm-hmm. the front lines. And so, yeah, when I went there, it gave me a very deep appreciation for him. And, you know, what I saw was truly a father of the church. And, yeah, so may his soul rest in peace indeed. Yeah.
So you're 21?
Yes, yeah, 21 years old.
And you've graduated from Newman, from the new BA degree in Catholic Studies that was formed there.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to go back. We'll move our way forward.
Sure.
To whatever extent you'd like to speak about this, what was your childhood formation like? You've grown up in a Catholic family.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a little glimpse of it.
Yeah, sure. So my both of my parents were not originally Catholic. And my dad responded to an altar calling when he was 16 or 17 years old and became an evangelical.
Mm.
And my mom's family was...
Who gave the altar call, do you know?
I'm not for sure. But so that was him. And then on my mom's side of the family, quite interestingly, her whole family dates back to, you know, the very early stages of when Calgary was founded as a city. So they've been in Calgary for a very, very long time. She's Scottish. And her whole family, no Christian background, I guess you could say. They just, not practicing.
Cowboy background.
Yeah, cowboy background, no religion.
No, cowboyism is a religion.
That's a good point. And so she also became an evangelical when she was 16 or 17 years old from an altar call. And then she brought her mom to the Sunday church service, and her mother also became a Christian. And so that always strikes me as interesting that she was the first in her family to take the leap of faith to be a part of something.
Do you know what churches they went to, both of them, initially?
Yes. Well, I know that they both met at Center Street Church in Calgary, which is near downtown, very vibrant, big church community. And yeah, I'm not for sure where she would have first gone. But regardless, they met in their 30s at a certain prayer conference. And by that time, my dad had been studying at the University of Laval, where he took his political science. And there he had come into an encounter with Opus Dei and met an Opus Dei priest and gradually came to become a Catholic. And so when my mom and him met and started dating, my mom was not Catholic yet and he was Catholic. And then, once things were getting more serious and they looks like they were going to eventually get married, my mom became a Catholic, and both of them had a very deep love for the Ukrainian Catholic liturgy. And so they got married at St. Basil's here in Edmonton.
Well, really?
Yeah.
Where does the Ukrainian Catholicism come into their life?
Well, my dad's Dutch and my mom's Scottish.
Oh,
so Scottish and Dutch together somehow create Ukrainian.
They got married at St. Basil's here in Edmonton on 9th Street.
So the truth is, I think they just fell in love with the Byzantine liturgy mm-hmm. and the incense and the singing. And that's where they ended up, that's what they called home. So I was baptized Ukrainian Catholic. And
here in Edmonton?
Here in Edmonton at St. Basil's.
Oh, really?
And I grew up going to St. Stephen's Ukrainian Catholic Church in Calgary, which was wonderful. And then from there, we did a lot of Catholic church hopping all over the place. But for the first, 10 years of my life, we routinely went every Sunday to St. Stephen's Ukrainian Catholic Church. Yeah, so how was I brought up?
Now, did you know Father Lacusta?
No, we would have had, Father Randy. He's the one who... Yeah, baptized me. And then when we were at St. Stephen's, it was Father Peter, and then Father Mark Bayrock, and also Father Boa.
Ah, wow.
Yeah, so.
Some familiar names to me.
Yes, yeah. Great. Yeah, no, I have very fond memories of going there for Sunday liturgy. Yeah, so for me, where did I first really get a lot of my Catholic formation was in the Sunday school classes at St. Stephen's. And then... In grade 5, I went to a school called St. John Choir Schola, which was being run out of St. John the Evangelist, which was at that time run by the Ordinariate.
The Anglicans.
Yeah.
Who had, by that time, had they entered the Catholic Church?
Yes, they had fully entered the Catholic Church.
I see.
And so Mrs. O'Neill, she started a, it was, I guess, a grade Yeah, I think it was about grade 1 to grade 12, about 35 people. So a very small group of Catholics. And 3 days a week, we were homeschooled. 2 days a week, we went to school there. And yeah, we had to memorize parts of the catechism.
What catechism?
The Baltimore Catechism.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yes. And we had Mass on Tuesday and Thursday with the Ordinariate rite, which was beautiful. And so I remember growing up, yeah, that was where I got a lot of good formation in my faith. But what I found was there were so many homeschoolers, and you know, living in Calgary, the backyard was so small, and the school to me at least felt very sheltered because it was just homeschoolers. So after about 2 years there, I was always complaining to my parents that it was only 2 days of the week that I got to socialize with people. And then the other 3 days of the week were just at the house homeschooling, which I didn't really love a whole lot. And I was really interested in politics and I wanted to become fluent in French. So I kept on nagging my parents that I needed to experience more of the world and kind of broaden my circle, and that it was important for me to not just be with Catholics, but no other people.
I take it your father is fluent in French.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So I actually convinced my parents that it would be a good idea to let me go to a public Catholic school in grade 7 to do French immersion. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up making that switch. And
in grade 7?
In grade 7. And that was a whole different world for me because, you know, there's lots of different public Catholic schools in Calgary, and some of them are fantastic and they do a very good job of integrating the faith. And other places are less skilled at that, and it's less rooted in the system. So I'd say when I went to grade 7 at St. Matthew's in Calgary and went to public school for French immersion, that was really my first encounter of being outside of a sheltered Catholic bubble. And you know, most of my peers didn't go to Mass on Sunday, and their parents didn't really care too much about the Catholic faith. A lot of the people in my class in grade 7 came from divorced families, so they didn't have that same bedrock that I had of, you know, appreciating a father and a mother who are, you know, close and married and have a unity in their marriage, which is so important for a child to be able to have, right? That's just a bedrock right there. And so that was really an eye-opener for me. And it was really quickly into that grade 7 year that I just found that it was really difficult for me to keep practicing basic virtues. And quickly things kind of fell apart about the more of the sheltered view I had of the world. And I got to come to experience a lot of peers who came from very broken families. You know, one of the phenomenas in public schools, particularly in grade 7 and grade 8, and this is still the case today, there's a lot of ladies in junior high school who are really struggling with self-esteem. And so in my class, there were a lot of peers in grade 7 who had issues with cutting themselves and depression and all sorts of things, right? And, you know, unfortunately, this is just, you know, a part of the reality of a lot of the brokenness in the 21st century we're living through, is there's so many people that are not happy. So when I was there in grade 7, it completely broke my sort of sheltered upbringing, and I really came into an encounter with a lot of people's brokenness and difficulties. And so what I found all of a sudden is, you know, I'm proud to be a Catholic and I love going to Mass every Sunday, and I appreciate all of that, but my faith isn't alive and well enough that if I'm to go into an environment with a lot of people who are struggling and don't have the answers to what helps make human happiness, I don't have the resources or, you know, enough of the formation of myself to actually give anything to them. And so what happens instead is if you're in a place like that and you don't have a deeply rooted formation and, you know, a good solid upbringing in your faith, well, then you just get dragged down by everybody around you. So that was grade 5, 6, and 7. And so when I was in grade 7, I got lots of bad marks on classes because everything was taught in French and I didn't know French. But now I can at least understand French and have the ability to speak it conversationally, which is, it's always fun to know another language and to be able to converse with people in it. And then grade 7 was around the time where I have 3 younger sisters and they're fantastic, but I don't have any brothers. And so...
What are your sisters' names?
Anastasia, which means resurrection, of course. Yeah,
it's a beautiful. Yeah.
And Alicia, and then Sophia.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so three beautiful, talented younger sisters. And yeah, one of them's done high school and she's pursuing work in social services in Calgary. And the other two are still in high school. And I'm very excited to see where the future takes all three of them because they're wonderful people. So in grade 7, I was reading Harry Potter. And I was entranced by the idea of a boarding school and living away from home. And I thought, you know, Harry Potter, Hermione Granger, Ron, they all have so much independence and they get to study at a boarding school away from their families and, you know, get to kind of pick their way in life. And Hogwarts is a school where there's so many outdoor grounds that you can run around on and have fun.
You know, I have a good friend who's the abbot of a monastery and an archbishop. And when he gets confronted in airports, he often says, you know, he's got monastic drag on. He often says that he's a recruiter for Hogwarts.
Oh, okay. Well, it's a well-done novel. And yeah, there's lots about it that's appealing. So I told my parents, I said, I really want to go to a boarding school. And, you know, my desire for a boarding school, I think, was to, number one, be in a place that had more outdoors and nature. And, you know, in grade 7, you know, I was just playing Minecraft and video games. Like, there wasn't much for me to do outside. And, you know, in grade 7, you can't drive yet, so you can't just drive to the mountains near Calgary, right? You're very dependent on other people for those things. And I didn't really know of any boarding schools that existed in Canada or the United States. So I just started doing my Googling and there's a family friend of ours, the Woodards, and their oldest, Greg Woodard, had gone to a boarding school in Mission, British Columbia, run by Benedictine monks, the Seminary of Christ the King. And so when I kept on pressing my parents about going to a boarding school, they introduced me to him. I got his email and I sent him a whole list of questions about the place itself. And my parents booked me a plane ticket, and I went over to the monastery in Mission, BC to check out their high school minor seminary program for 4 days. And that was a remarkable experience coming from public school into that, because when I went there for the come and see, I mean, first of all, every single day we woke up at 5:45 a.m. It was my first encounter with the Liturgy of the Hours, so we had morning prayer. And then we got to go to Mass with the Benedictine monks at 6:30 in the morning, and then breakfast. And there's no technology there whatsoever. And, you know, so what do you do in...
No cell phones, no television, no nothing. iPads, nothing like that.
Yeah, and so it was my first time being in a place technology-free where, there was an encounter with the Liturgy of the Hours, and then in free time, you know, playing sports and... growing up as boys should grow up, right? Doing things outside and playing sports and having fun. And so then they had a Friday holy hour in which they would sing Taizé chants. And I remember...
So Taizé is a French ecumenical movement which brought Catholics and Protestants together. And I've known lots of people that they have a whole musical... style, which is beautiful.
Yeah, and we had tremendous once a year at Mission BC we would have a Taizé night evening. And the whole the whole Westminster Abbey church was filled with about 800 people, Protestants and Catholics together, and we would sing Taizé chants for an hour and then have 30 minutes of silence, and then we would end with the Salve Regina. And it was those were some of the most beautiful evenings actually I've ever been blessed to partake in. So I went there and we were doing the Taizé chants, and Jesus was right there present inside of the monstrance. And I was just staring at the host and, you know, firmly believed inside of my heart that like Jesus Christ is physically present right here on the altar and I'm staring at him. So I was just staring at the host, acknowledging his presence. And, you know, I really prayed because I did find my experience in grade 7 to be rough. And I was praying about the different people that I had met that were broken. And I was also asking Jesus, like, there's got to be more to life than just having a small backyard in Calgary and, you know, playing video games. And then Jesus just gave me this overwhelming peace. And I just knew right there in that instant that I had to go to that boarding school to pursue my high school. So, yeah, the following year in September, my mom drove me to Mission, BC. And as a mother would, who's letting their grade eight go to the under the care of monks, right? She burst into tears and was just devastated, gave me a big hug. And then apparently it took her a good month of adjustment to kind of reckon with the fact that I wasn't living at home anymore. Myself, on the other hand, as soon as I got there, it was paradise. I was one of the few students that didn't have any homesickness. I did miss my family a lot, and, you know, I love being with my family, but for me, everything was just so new and beautiful and such a freeing experience to just be without technology, liturgy of the hours every single day, and, you know, soccer, frisbee, and to be taught by monks, which was, that was also very interesting. and the two things that I think that were very, very present in my high school experience at Mission BC were community and good liturgy. And I couldn't identify those words at the time. Like, I wouldn't, you know, while I was at Mission BC, I couldn't tell you that the two things that were making me so happy were liturgy and community, and that's what was really sustaining my spiritual life and giving me happiness and making me super excited to wake up every single morning to the sound of church bells and, you know, the singing of Vespers and everything else. But those two things were very precious, and I got to experience those on a daily basis while I was there. I mean, there's tons of stories I could tell you about studying with the monks, and...
Well, give us a couple.
Yeah, one of the monks, Father Nicholas, he came from Switzerland, and his vocation story is that he didn't know if he wanted to be a priest or get married. He just loved farming, and he loved praying. And so he moved to the greater Vancouver area to start farming in the Fraser Valley. And he came to the Fraser Valley, and then he heard the monastic bells one day, and he walked up to the monastery, and he said, wow, a community of monks that work and pray. And then he said,
Benedictine rule.
Yeah, and then he said, you know what, that's the life for me. And he became a monk and a priest. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So when I was there, he was 93 or 94 years old, mm-hmm. and you would not have been able to guess it. And even though he was that old, he was always out working with the monks and doing different things. So I remember one tradition we had in the minor seminary was at Christmas time, we would put up a Christmas tree, but we'd have to cut that Christmas tree ourselves from the property. And so we cut down a Christmas tree and we put it just outside of the minor seminary where there was some grass. And Father Nicholas is deaf and he's always looking for work to do. And so he came by in his tractor and saw the tree there, and he saw, what? Like, who just left a whole bunch of, who left a tree here and didn't chop it up into wood to burn?
Oh, you're kidding.
And so we were doing midday prayer or something. And when we exited midday prayer, Father Nicholas was just out there with a chainsaw cutting the Christmas tree into blocks to prepare it for firewood. And there was nothing we could do because you couldn't have a conversation with him because he was deaf. So nobody could really explain. And everybody was terrified of him because he had such a thick, strong Swedish accent. So the only time I had a conversation with him is when I was finishing doing dishes in the dishwasher system they had after lunch. I was driving the cart too fast with all of the dishes, and he stopped me in the hallway and he just said, "Fool! Fool!" And then he took the cart and pushed it for me. So everybody was fairly scared of him. and he just, he always did manual labor. So that was a good story. Praying with the monks was fun. Work period every Saturday, we got to work from 1 to 4 p.m. on the monastic property, and we'd get to work with the monks, and once a year we would have chicken butcherings, which was lots of fun. I remember one year one of the minor seminarians was in charge of gutting the chickens, and they actually took the gutted parts and threw them and started a
little food fight.
Yeah, I guess not a snowball fight, but the insides of a chicken fight.
Oh my Lord.
And then he got in a lot of trouble because obviously, you know, mm-hmm. you can't do that. And then shoveling steer barns and taking care of the cows. Brother Maximus went to Thomas Aquinas College. He was one of the monks that I looked up to a lot, who helped me a lot to grow as a person and, you know, encouraged me along my journey in the faith. And him and I started a great books club at Newman. So we started with the Apology.
A great books club where?
At the Seminary
at
of
the
Christ
Seminary.
The King.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we started out with the Apology, and then I recruited some of my peers.
Plato's Apology.
Yes, yeah. And yeah, so I spoke very highly of that and recruited some of my peers, and then we had five or six of us that met once a week. And we started with the Apology, and then we read the Iliad, and then we dipped into the Republic. So yeah, it was a very beautiful place. Another cool aspect about the Minor Seminary is that there's a guest house on it where people can come to do retreats. And so all of the people who are coming up there to do retreats are coming there at a time in their life when they're looking for some renewal, and you know, they're looking to encounter Christ and figure out what God is calling them to do next. Or and so that was always a blessing. This wasn't the case for all the minor seminarians, but being the extrovert that I am, whenever people came for retreats, if I saw them outside going for a walk, I would always run up to them and ask them, "What's your name? And what are you here for?"
You'd interrupt their contemplation.
Well, I'd interrupt their contemplation, but I'd interrupt their contemplation by kind of getting to know where life has brought them, mm-hmm. and, you know, why they're searching for contemplation or what they're mm-hmm. hoping to achieve in contemplation. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I can get a broader understanding of mm-hmm. everybody's individual human experience and see how all of those people are searching for God in some capacity. And then being in grade 9 or grade 10, I couldn't offer them any wisdom, but I could offer them joy and encouragement for whatever had brought them to our place. And I mean, I guess a final thing I can add is the core experience of the Minor Seminary was always rooted in fostering a personal encounter with the person of Jesus Christ. And that was always at the core of why we did Vespers, Holy Hours, Mass, and well, you know, how we treated each other as friends was always focused on how we can help each other to grow closer to the person of Christ. And so the place was, you know, very spiritual and great formation. And I remember whenever I left the Minor Seminary to go home for Christmas or Easter or the summer, as soon as I went off of the property line in a car to go to the airport, it felt like I was exiting a spiritual force field. And, you know, you really begin to understand how important it is for the church to have a strong amount of people in the religious life, because those monks have the job of praying for everybody in the church and praying for the Holy Father and for the world. And so the first abbot of the Minor Seminary while I was there, he was actually also the head exorcist for the Diocese of Vancouver. And the Satanist groups inside of Vancouver would position themselves, you know, away from the monastery, but in opposition to it. And so you kind of understood how important it was for the monks to pray, because, you know, you could see how it was a spiritual headquarters for praying for God's providence to bless the world. And the fact that the forces of the evil one would actually position themselves in opposition to that physically. And, you know,
I mean, like literally they would come to mission?
Yeah, they would come to mission. We
on the road going by the monastery there?
Yeah, there was always issues with
the cemetery across the street.
Yeah, there's the cemetery across the street. But also we had different groups who would come in and try to either vandalize the church or desecrate the graves where the monks were buried.
I see. Mm-hmm.
So I remember one time I was going for a walk with a monk, and there were two people that were coming to desecrate the graves and do something on it. And me and the monk were walking at 9:30 at night, so it was dark outside, and you couldn't even see them, but he knew something was awry there, and he said, "We need to go to the graveyard right now, because there's people coming up here to try to desecrate the place where the monks are buried," and he was right. And so there were different things of that were just so eye-opening, right? The depth of the spiritual life, and that there's actually people that are so devoted to prayer out there that they do get nudges from God of go to this physical location right now because you need to be there because something bad is happening. So that was a very, very powerful experience.
So you were there through grade 12?
Just till grade 10. So this is really interesting because, you know, reflecting on this now, I can see very clearly why God brought me to Newman and what about Newman was so special, because it was in grade 10 while I was at the Minor Seminary that the COVID-19 pandemic occurred. Oh. And we had just been sent home for a February 4-day break. And it was during that 4-day break when I was at home that restrictions started to come in. And so we weren't allowed to fly back to the monastery for school. That had kind of been the first announcement that there would be a 2-week hiatus to travel and there'd be a need to quarantine when you get back to places. So the monastery just decided, well, we'll wait it out 2 weeks. Students can stay home for 2 weeks and then they can come back to the monastery once things settle down. But the settling down never occurred and the 2 weeks turned into months and then years. So I was at home and the monks had to transition from, you know, doing classes inside of a monastery to figuring out how to use Zoom.
Ah.
And I was just...
Technology.
Yes, exactly. Well, and I was devastated because, you know, it was a hard thing to just be inside of my room in my house with nothing to do except the online classes. So I very, very quickly got bored and I thought, well, what can I do to complement my high school studies, you know, while I'm taking these Zoom classes with the monks? And so I started to search for jobs and I had a friend who knew of a lawn care company called Yard Dogs. So I thought, well, they're not doing any yard work in February, but perhaps I could go and clean their shop once a week. So I went there for an interview and right away in the interview we clicked. They asked me what I like to do in my free time. And I said, well, right now I'm reading Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life. And they're like, oh, Jordan Peterson, he's that guy who got in trouble at the University of Toronto for saying that, you know, the only two genders are male and female. And I said, yeah, that's him. And right away we had a good common connection.
So how old were you?
I was 16 years old.
You were 16 and you were reading Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life.
Yeah, so that was another benefit. I mean, we had spiritual reading every day at Mission BC. So I consumed a lot of books and they had a two-story library. So the amount of reading you could do there was truly, it was endless. So I was talking with them and they said, hey, you're really good at socializing and talking. Like, we don't have any cleaning job, but do you want to try doing sales for us? And I said, well, I could try that. And they said, well, right now we don't really have any leads for you to call or people interested in lawn care. But if you want to try it, we could purchase a list of 500 phone numbers in Calgary and you could just call and see what happened.
So chat them up.
Yeah. So that was my first time ever doing something in sales. I'd done lots of door knocking for political parties before that when I was in grade 7, grade 8, and grade, lots. But I tried it and surprisingly, I did the calls and I was getting people's credit card numbers and they were booking a lawn care service, just a complete number out of the blue. Hmm. And I called them and asked how they were doing and started to get bookings for them. So after that, it became complicated with classes because the snow melted and then there were tons and tons of phone calls to do and tons of sales to sell. So I remember I had my office at Yard Dogs where I did my sales and I'd have my Zoom class with my camera off and my mic muted. And I would be doing sales calls while class was going on.
Oh my, Victor, shouldn't be telling me this.
Well, it was just for, not every class, but just when it was necessary. But I would multitask and do both at the same time. And anyway, so when I did sales for them, we went, when I started with them, the company wasn't doing too much in revenue. But by the time I finished the year with them, they ended the year off at about 500K. And I had sold most of that. They doubled their lawn care team. I made a very good friendship with my bosses and it was truly remarkable. So the success story of me in sales kind of went back to the monastery and I was talking with the monks about it. And a few of the monks felt that the pool at the seminary was too small for me and they saw that I had a talent and that that talent was serving me very well. I also felt that despite how much of a blessing it was to go away for 3 years, I thought that it might be good for me to absorb the last two high school years with my parents and my younger sisters and to be a good present older brother for them and a good son for my parents. So yeah, I prayed about it and ultimately I decided that I would go to Calgary for high school. Mm-hmm. And I chose a high school called Bishop Carroll High School. And Bishop Carroll is self-directed, so you take the courses at your own pace. You only go into the high school when you need to write tests. So you can study from home or in the evenings and then go in there for one day and write 5 tests and move through things at your own pace. So I got about 80% of my high school done in 1 year. And the whole time that I was in high school, I'd do my studies in the evening. I would write a test at the high school for about 1 day a week. And the rest of the time I was working a sales job with Yard Dogs from 9 to 5 selling lawn care. And yeah, we eventually grew to about, 1.2 million in revenue. The company expanded to Edmonton and Red Deer. I got to go on business trips with my bosses to Florida, Boston, and I got promoted to the role of sales manager. So I actually managed a team of 4 employees. And I had to make sure the 2 sales reps hit their weekly targets. And I was
this is when you were in high school.
Yeah, so I was still 17, and then when I was before I was 18, we did a trip to Florida, And in Florida, my bosses offered me a deal, and they said, if you want to sign a contract saying you're going to work for us for 5 years, we'll give you 12.5% of equity in the company. And so all of a sudden, I hadn't even turned 18 yet. And, you know, I was making very good money doing sales and had an offer to buy into Yard Dogs. But while this was happening, my spiritual life was really going down the drain. And I didn't really understand why, because I had had such a good experience at Mission BC. I really cared about people encountering Christ, and I really cared about my Catholic faith tremendously. But for some reason, I just couldn't put it into practice the same way without having the regular prayer routine structured into the minor seminary, and without having all of those good friendships. And I didn't really understand why that was the case, but I was struggling a lot, and I was making all of this money. But, you know, when you start to make a good amount of money, but you're not married, and you don't have kids, and you don't have a vocation in life, you know, I mean, the question's glaring right at you. What is even the purpose of this money or the use of this money if I have nothing higher to give it towards? So I was really perplexed, and I was feeling quite down. I was making good money, and I had a good, bright future ahead of me if I wanted to buy into the company. But I just wasn't happy inside, and I didn't see how becoming a rich business owner would make me happy, right? It kind of seemed like a dead end. And so when I was at that business trip in Florida and they offered that to me, after one of our business meetings, I was on the balcony of where we were staying, and I was sitting there, and the wind was blowing and the stars were beautiful. And
in Florida.
It was right by in Fort Lauderdale. Hmm. And the place we had was right by the beach. So while I was sitting there, you could smell the salty ocean, and it was a beautiful environment. And I just remember I cried, and I got down on my knees, and I said, like, Jesus, this is really, like, I'm not happy working the sales job I'm working, and I don't understand what the purpose of it all is. And I really missed the minor seminary. I missed being in a place where there was regular prayer. And what I missed even more so was the monastic community and the community of my fellow brother minor seminarians. Because that was the greatest beauty of being in Mission BC for 3 years, as I had, you know, there were monks there who took prayer so seriously and were so virtuous, self-giving, and would just sacrifice so much for the students there to help us grow in our faith and to teach us. And so you had these perfect incarnate models of good father figures and good holy men that you could look to in times of distress and say, wow, I actually have a human example and a human model for how I can be a good Catholic and grow in my faith. And then you could also take from that same, you know, model and, you know, in your own spiritual life, you could also give to your younger brothers at the minor seminary, right? And I really miss that. So I got on my knees and I just prayed, like, Jesus, please, I don't think that I want to just work here in business for 5 years. I need to re-encounter and understand what was so precious about my experience inside of the minor seminary from grade 8 to grade 10. What was in it in my 3 years of formation that is so essential to what it means to be human that I'm missing right now? And, you know, one of the reasons that I was sad for missing it is because I recognized that whatever I was missing, the world needed. And so that was an extra perplexing problem, because if the world needs something and I need it, well, then not only am I disserviced because I don't have what I need, but, you know, as social creatures, our goal is to bring goodness to our neighbors and to the rest of humanity. And so what bothered me even more is that, you know, for my friends around me and all the humans that I meet, I don't have that joy or thing to give them that the world is so desperately looking for.
So this sense of recognizing that the world needs something. Mm-hmm. Does that go back to your experience in the Catholic high school or the Catholic school, where you saw young people, quite young, mm-hmm. cutting themselves, mm-hmm. sense of depression and what have you? Did that echo there? Is that?
Yeah, that echoed there as well, because it was the same when I went to work business. When we went to the States for different conferences where we got to be with business owners, the same thing that I saw in those students in grade 7 mm-hmm. is the same thing that I saw when I was in Bishop Carroll High School in grade 11 and grade 12. I mean, the amount of high schoolers who, you know, there's a significant amount of the population in public high schools that, you know, experiment with drugs and drinking in high school. And they also come from very broken homes, too. And then those same types of brokenness you can see amongst all of your business peers. When you're mm-hmm. meeting with a whole bunch of businessmen in the States, I mean, there were 50-year-old men that were multimillionaires. And I could look into their eyes when I was talking with them, and I could see they're missing that same thing. And they're just as sad as those people that I met in high school and other places. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was a recognition that that resonated through all of those experiences for sure. So the prayer that I said was very heartfelt, and, you know, I really thought that God could hear me. And because there was so much emotion in my prayer and desperation, by the time I had finished my prayer, I just had to let go of that desperation and say, you know what, like, the Lord has it. He's got me covered. I trust in him. He has to have it, because I can't carry the weight of all of that myself, right? So I kind of just let go. And then went back to Calgary after the business trip and kept doing sales for the company I was working for. And yeah, out of the blue, at that time I was going to the St. Francis Xavier Chaplaincy in Calgary, which had a young adults mass every Sunday at 4 p.m. at St. Mary's Cathedral. And so they had a speaker over after mass, Dr. Ryan Topping from Newman Theological College. And he was coming down to give a talk on the liberal arts and about Newman Theological College.
And so this is, what year is this?
So this is in the March or April of, March or April of 2022.
I see.
And it was just after I had turned 18 years old. Yeah.
So the program at Newman was underway. They'd gotten a degree. They'd come through COVID.
Yes.
So he was down doing a little recruiting.
Yes. So it was right after the very first year of the BA's existence. Mm-hmm. And so he gave a talk, and the talk was fantastic.
What was it about?
The talk itself was about rebuilding Catholic culture, and the talk was good. There's nothing from it I can remember, because this is what actually enticed me to go to Newman. So after the talk was done, there were some friends of mine who enjoyed philosophy and theology who were talking with Dr. Topping, and there was maybe five of us that were there standing in a circle, and they were talking about some sort of a theological question from the Summa, and I was sitting there. And, you know, for me, I can be a quite prideful person. So in Calgary, whenever I was in groups of intellectuals and they were talking about philosophy or theology, and I felt bad that I didn't have anything to contribute and that I didn't understand what they were saying, I would always say in the back of my head, well, Victor, you're a really successful salesperson, and you're doing really well for yourself. So even though these people are talking about philosophy and theology and you don't understand, have recourse to your ego. You know, you're better than them, and you don't have to worry about what they're saying. So that was always my default, and
So Satan was around.
Satan was around, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Appeal to the pride, and, you know, then I can feel better about myself. But when they were talking, all of a sudden, you know, I realized that I was completely absent and left out of what they were talking about. And I saw the look of joy on their faces of what they were talking about, and you know, Dr. Topping left quite an impression on me when he gave his talk. It was a good talk. And I just thought, wow, there's something really deep and beautiful here that I have no knowledge of and I'm missing out on. And I don't want to live a life where I'm not tapped into whatever is giving them this joy in conversation. And so I had a deep feeling of, oh, no, this is this is not good. Mm. So after that, I decided, well, I better at least, you know, go to Newman Theological College and check it out and pray about it. Back when I was in Mission, BC, because Brother Maximus and I had read the Apology from Plato and the Iliad, mm-hmm. I had some understanding of the great books. And before I had started sales, my original plan was to go to Thomas Aquinas College to get an undergrad there.
Where is that?
That's in California. Huh. Yeah. And so I kind of remembered, oh, yeah, like at a certain point, I did actually want to take philosophy as an undergrad. And so it kind of sparked in me, or at least reminded me of that that desire that I once had when, you know, originally. And so, yeah, I scheduled a weekend to go up to Edmonton, and I had a pretty good idea. I thought, even though I hadn't studied the incarnation or anything about the body and soul unity of the person, I'd always thought it's very important to not just spiritually pray apart from doing something physical, but to have both. And so I thought it would be a great
very
idea.
Benedictine.
Yeah, it is yeah. very, yeah, you're right. Yeah. And so I had the idea of going to Edmonton, and because my parents, they met in Edmonton, they got married in Edmonton, my dad proposed to my mother in Edmonton, and that's where they had their first house. I thought, well, you know what, I will go to all of the places that they met and where we got our first house, and I'll go to it. While I'm there, I'll pray, and then I'll visit Newman Theological College as my last destination and go there and, you know, pray while I'm actually physically at the place that I would potentially go to.
And so it's a pilgrimage.
Yeah, and I'll see if God gives me a firm example. And see, that's really cool. All of these concepts we're talking about, pilgrimage, body, soul, unity. Like, I didn't have words for those.
Right, yeah.
But yet my human nature, it was just a part of my human nature to naturally do those things, even though I didn't have a word to identify what precisely those were.
That's because the great holy tradition is actually about the human nature.
Yes, well, and that's something that Newman would put into words and categorize for me. So I emailed my dad, and I asked him for the addresses of where they first lived. And when I went to Edmonton, I actually door knocked on those addresses. So I went to the first one, and there was a Muslim family living there. And I explained to them, I said, this is where my parents bought their first house. And this is where I was when I was 6 months old. Do you mind if I come in and have tea with you guys for 30 minutes? And so they were like, oh, sure. And so they came in, there was a beautiful rug mat and pillows. And I sat and had tea with them for 30 minutes. And I explained, you know, I got offered to buy into a company. I've been doing well in sales, but I don't feel happy. And I'm looking for happiness. And, you know, I'm the type of guy where I can, you know, I'm never going to see a stranger again at a bus stop. That Muslim family that I had tea with, I'm probably never going to see them again. So why not open up my heart to them? And why don't they open up their heart to me? And why don't we see how we can enrich each other as human beings? Because, you know, time is sparse and we're probably not going to connect again. So that's what I did. And I went to the first, one of the experiences that was powerful for me is I went to the first apartment that my mom and dad lived together in. And it was in the sketchiest part of Edmonton ever. It was super run down. They told me at the time when they lived there, they would have cops once a week in their back alley because there'd be some sort of crime going on there. And then I thought of my dad taking law school. And, you know, my dad has always used his law degree for causes that he's passionate about that have to do with justice. And if you're a lawyer that is devoted to causes you're passionate about for the sake of justice and you want to help out people, then there's not money in that to begin with, because oftentimes the people who need help don't have a lot of money. And so I thought of my dad and I thought, wow, like here he was in his early 30s, married at a really rundown apartment, probably not with a lot of financial security, but what mattered to him was doing something that would service other people and would produce some good in society. And so I kind of reflected on myself and I was like, wow, like with the money I'm making doing sales, you know, I don't have a connection to some sort of social duty with it. And, you know, suddenly it kind of gripped my heart that, you know, I had definitely had an attachment to money that was hindering me from pursuing things of that were greater. Yeah. Yeah. And then I went to Newman itself, and Newman at the time didn't have any classes. So I was walking around Newman with my rosary and I was just poking my eyes through the windows, trying to look at what the inside was like. And then walked by what I guessed was the Jesus statue, which was confirmed. Yeah. And
this is the large statue that used to sit at Newman when it was on St. Albert Trail.
Mm-hmm.
And they moved it to the new destination there.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was good. And then, you know, I had emailed Dr. Topping to say I was coming up to Newman for to check it out and see it. And he said, well, that's unfortunate because, you know, Newman is closed right now and there's no classes. And so, he invited me to where they go for Sunday Mass. And so I had a chance to meet him, one of the professors at Newman. And that's what really sealed the deal for me for coming to Newman, is when I went to Mass, I had the chance to meet his wife and his family. And
were they going to the Latin Mass?
Yes, yeah. And that was my first time going to a Sunday Latin Mass as well. And when I met his family, all of a sudden, that was a whole other new experience in and of itself. I'd never seen a family quite like that, where, you know, I had seen somebody like Dr. Topping that had, 10 kids, 9 boys and 1 girl. And I guess I really saw in that...
She's a very special girl.
Yes, yes. Yes, she is. She's got 9 warriors to protect her. That's from anything. Right. Looking out for her. Yeah. And so I got to meet him and his family, and I talked a little bit about my decision-making process. And, you know, he talked to me about the liberal arts. And really, the conversations around the liberal arts were good. But when I met his family, what I saw was 2 very happy parents and a really strong Catholic couple and 10 kids who were just super joyful and very happy. And so it was an encounter with a very beautiful image of the domestic church. And when I got to meet his family, I could just see that, Catholicism and studying the liberal arts wasn't just a mere intellectual thing, but that, you know, the fruits of Dr. Topping's education clearly flowed into how he was raising his kids. And the fruit of that was that his family was very, very happy. And so when I saw that, I kind of thought to myself, well, yeah, in the long run, I want to get married and have kids and be a father one day. And I thought, it seems that the liberal arts and studying what the Catholic Church has to offer produces direct fruit in happiness and human virtue and how one lives their life. So after that, I went back to Calgary and I decided, you know what? I'm 18 years old. I'm sure when I'm 28, 30, I can, you know, if I want to, I can go back to sales and make lots of money. Right now, my soul needs whatever I'm seeing in these people who talk about philosophy and theology, and I do not want to deprive myself of that. So at the time, I was really, really good friendship with my bosses, and I was so stressed out and anxious about telling them that I was going to turn down being offered equity in a company so that I could go study the liberal arts. And for them as business people, you know, the connotation around the liberal arts is, okay, you're going to become a Starbucks barista after that, right? It's a... you know, it's not something that the business community sees as a particularly worthwhile university experience most of the time. So I remember whenever I was stressed at that time or really, really anxious, I would always get these breakouts on my neck, this rash. And normally that would take 2 or 3 days to form with gradual amounts of stress. Because one of the things, like when I was 17 years old, there was one point that our company was in debt and I was responsible for hitting a sales target to get us out of that. And so to be under that amount of stress as a 17-year-old, right? It's not easy. So anyway, I didn't have any rash leading up to my conversation with them. But then when I talked with them over coffee and I said, yeah, I'm not going to be pursuing equity in the company and I'm going to go in September to take a liberal arts degree at a Catholic college. As soon as I said that, I was sweating so much, I instantly got this breakout on my neck. And before my bosses could even give their thoughts on what I had said, they said, oh, but Victor, you have a really big rash on your neck. And it literally appeared within just a minute of me, you know, saying the words that I didn't want to work with them. So it was hard. I mean, doing business with the same people for 2.5 years, you really forge a strong friendship. And that's primarily because it's rooted in, you know, the best of times and the worst of times and walking through that together. But I told them and they wished me well. And yeah, in September, I began my studies at Newman.
So that's September?
September 2022.
2022.
Yeah, so this was the second year of the Bachelor of Arts in Catholic Studies existence. Yeah. Yeah, and well, where should I go from here? Should I just talk about my first week at Newman?
Well, so, what do you think? You came to Newman in September.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I remember my dad drove me up, and so interestingly enough, Edmonton had most of, there were a few people in Edmonton who had finished their education at the Minor Seminary in Mission, BC, and they had a men's house in Sherwood Park called St. Pete's, and so I got myself a spot in that house, and I moved up with my dad, and there were about 5 of us in the house, I think. Yeah, with people that I had known beforehand, so that was a real blessing. And then I went to Newman the first day, and of course, I'm from Calgary, and everybody there's from Edmonton. So the first day to really leave a mark and an impression,
I have to tell them where Calgary is, because nobody in Edmonton knows where Calgary is. We've never heard of it.
Well, no, but you know what they do know is the Calgary Flames. So the first day that I went to Newman Theological College, I wore my Flame shirt because I thought, then everybody will remember my name the first day. I won't have to keep repeating my name to people. And it leaves a distinctive mark of, I'm not afraid to be controversial. I'm not afraid to wear the opposing team right into the center of things. And I thought it was the best way to introduce them to my personality is, you know, then they can know me as well as is possible on the first day just from that, right? Anyway.
I've never really thought about it before, but on the one hand, we have the Flames, and on the other hand, we have the Oilers.
Yes.
And, of course, oil produces flames.
Yep. Well, it's true. Well, and because I'm born in Edmonton, even though I was raised in Calgary for 17 years, now after 3 years in Edmonton, just to clarify for everybody, I'm cheering for the Oilers, so I'm no longer a Flames fan. Maybe I'll go back and forth between them, depending on how the future leads me. But when I came for the first day, it was remarkable. I mean, I didn't know that the college was so small, so I wasn't aware that the first year of their Bachelor of Arts program only had 4 lay students and 4 seminarians.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that it was just 8 people. There was nothing of numbers that I researched beforehand. But in my class, there were 12 other people, apart from myself, who applied for that the first year year 1 of the BA in the year 2022. And yeah, I'm walking with them. And we went down for a walk by the River Valley, and Dr. Fast was taking us on that walk. And he asked everybody, I'm like, who here is baptized Ukrainian Catholic? And my hand went up with 1 or 2 others. Mm. And then, you know, a few people who here goes to the Latin Mass. There were a few people who here goes to this parish, that parish. What's everybody's background? And what I saw was, you know, the 13 of us who were on the hike, we all had very different backgrounds in the Catholic Church. And, you know, for some reason, despite all these different backgrounds, we're all here to take a Bachelor of Arts in Catholic Studies together. And so I noticed that there's a lot of different differences between our classmates. And then at the same time, I mean, our year just instantly hit it off tremendously. And right away, there were friendships forming left, right, and center. And yeah, the first year of the BA, we went on a beautiful retreat to Way of Holiness by Jasper. And
what is that?
So the Way of Holiness, it's a retreat center. I think it's about a 20 minute drive from Jasper. And yeah, they host retreats out there several times through the year. You can book a private retreat if you're wanting to just go hike in the mountains for a few days and also have access to pray at the Blessed Sacrament, then you can call them and book a room. So we drove 3 hours as a class together from Edmonton to the Way of Holiness Center. And we had 3 days of some talks and then going on a hike together as classmates. And, it was very beautiful. I remember going on the hike that if there were some people from Saskatchewan, and some people from Northern Alberta. Anyway, for some of the people, they had never been hiking a mountain before, so it was quite a hard task. And when we were climbing, quite a few people got out of breath and wanted to turn around halfway. But then, you know, in those moments of trial and difficulty trying to surmount a mountain, right away there were people in our class that were like, no, like, you got this, like, yeah, you're from Saskatchewan and it might be flat there, but, you know, come on, we got this. Like, can we slow down the pace or get you some water? What would be best?
So
we encouraged them and we went on the hike together, and, you know, it was right away a good moment of bonding, but also doing a difficult task together. Yeah, so that was a lot of fun. And yeah, then studies started. We got to read in our Intro to Catholic Studies class with Dr. Topping St. Augustine's Confessions, the Aeneid, and an Historical Introduction to Philosophy with Dr. Fast. We started off with the Iliad, and then after that we went into the Republic, and then after the Republic, Boethius, Consolation of Philosophy. And then we had our Way of Beauty class with Mr. Bryce, where we got to read all of the documents from the Magisterium about liturgy and sacred music, which was truly beautiful. Yeah, what stood out to me most for my 3 years in my Bachelor of Arts in Catholic Studies program? I think really what I fundamentally came to realize through studying at Newman at 3 years was what I appreciated so much at the Minor Seminary of Christ the King was good community and good liturgy that was all focused on the person of Christ and leading us towards him. And those were things that I didn't have a name for, but that I re-encountered at Newman in a much deeper capacity. And with the intellectual resources and the reading of the great books that made me capable to actually articulate those things to other people and to be able to articulate, you know, what about community and liturgy is so important for the human person and for human flourishing and for happiness. And, you know, once I kind of got my mind around those two things and how they were present at Newman Theological College and the fact that I had missed out on those things after I left the minor seminary for a brief period, it's given me the foundation with which I think I can serve and give to the rest of the world. Yeah, certainly made me a very happy individual. I mean, yeah, from being in the BA for 3 years, you know, there's certain things that you learn and that you incarnate into your soul that'll just stay with you forever. And, you know, I have those things in a manner now where they really can't be uprooted by anything. And so I'm very thankful for that.
Hopefully. I'm not certain how to ask this, and I'm not certain it's an appropriate question even. But let me walk around it a little bit. Is there anything in this study for you through Newman that shifted or enlarged your sense of the civil world? So, I mean, I'm aware from our conversations that you have given a lot of attention to party politics, to the way in which in our democratic society we shape the political sphere, which is, to my mind, a little peculiar at this point.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me that party politics, that there's a modest amount, if any, politics in it. There's a lot of party in it. And we live in a kind of world where the discourse around politics is pretty siloed, where so often, at least it's my sense, and I mean, I know the left more than the right, where identifying with the particular issues in a particular silo is your entrance into the party and your way of identifying with it and of being faithful and righteous in terms of their particular positions. And you have, if I've understood, you have primarily located yourself in the current iterations of conservative politics here. Has the study of the great books and of both its love of learning and its desire for God, as that has unfolded at Newman, has that had ways of deepening or texturing your way of understanding your particular interests in politics and in the what I have characterized as the kind of siloed character of our politics at this point?
Yeah.
Any shifts in that for you?
Well, yeah, a little bit in how I approach things. I mean, the first thing is, you know, one of the best things about Newman Theological College with its Bachelor of Arts in Catholic Studies is Socratic dialogue and conversation. And so, of course, when we're reading all of the great books, you know, we're not just getting lectures from professors about them, but we're reading the books to try to step into somebody's mind and think the way that they think, and then to take what we draw from that and present it to our peers, and then all of a sudden to see how they engaged with thinking with the author and what they pulled out of it. And when you're doing that, the first thing you're trying to do is you're trying to understand the author And less than understanding the solutions that an author puts forward, you're trying to understand the problem that they see. So I had a really interesting encounter when I read the Communist Manifesto.
Oh.
Because...
Did you read that with Dr. Fass?
Yes, yeah, we read that with Dr. Fass. And, you know, at the beginning, it's lamenting the fact at how work has pulled so many people away from the mm-hmm. important things of life. And, it's talking about, you know, the problems of unrestricted capitalism on the human person. And so when I was reading the problems part, I was like, wow, this author, like, he's really picking up on some really big problems that exist in society. And then we got to the solution part, and
Uncle Carl's diagnosis is pretty good.
Yeah, his diagnosis is fantastic. And it was the diagnosis part I was resonating with so much and I was appreciating. And then I got to the solution part and I thought, okay, well, there's a lot of things with the solutions mm-hmm. that I think are just abysmal. It makes sense how that led to the mass murder of tens of millions of people mm-hmm. in China and the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. It's no surprise at all. But it was an interesting experience because I went to it with an idea of trying to understand the problem that he saw. And, you know, in doing that, I think if Marx was alive today, we could have a pretty good conversation because I could understand the problem that he saw and we could have a fantastic time talking about different solutions for that. And I could present to him maybe some different ideas. But that's translated for me into politics a lot because, you know, I'm a conservative and I've been very involved with the UCP. But I'm in Edmonton and there's tons of NDPers in Edmonton. And so I kind of switched how I went into conversations with people where I'm like, okay, let's find the problem that we can agree on first, right? Let's mm-hmm. let's figure that out and hear what you have to say. And right away, all of a sudden, we're establishing a common ground where we're putting into the forefront our like-mindedness. And, you know, as Aristotle says, the basis for friendship is mm-hmm. like-mindedness. So, you know, Aristotle in the Nicomachean Ethics and the Politics talking about the value and importance of friendship. It's like, okay, well, we're both human beings, a part of the same civil society, so we need to have some sort of like-mindedness that enables us to have a friendship. And so that comes first and foremost from trying to figure out, okay, well, if we can't agree on solutions, I think it's plausible that we can agree on a problem that exists. And then that friendship is established, that like-mindedness is established, and we're no longer enemies on separate sides of the political spectrum, but we're actually friends with something in common. And then putting the problem out there, well, then we can approach the solutions. And now that we've established a commonality and a friendship, we can be on very opposing sides for what a solution might be, or we might be similar and not far off. But if we're on very opposing sides for what we see as a solution to a problem, there is much more freedom and flexibility to engage in that conversation because the basis of the first part of our conversation was on friendship. And so we're no longer enemies. And so when we're getting into a sparring match around ideas, there's not a risk of, it's not a war field. It's a conversation, right? So there's something enriching about that. I would say that the second thing about Newman that really influenced my politics, in Dr. Topping's class, we were talking about three components of medieval society, and we were talking about three types of fatherhood. And so we were talking about how medieval society respected the idea of God the Father and his fatherhood over creation. And then secondarily, that, you know, patriotism was a virtue, right? So when you look at your monarch or your political leaders, their duty is to exercise a type of fatherhood and care over their nation.
All of their nation.
Yes.
Everybody. Not just the people that agree with them.
Exactly. Well, and like how often today would we, you know, I don't think we would put Donald Trump, Kamala Harris, Pierre Poilievre, Mark Carney, Justin Trudeau, Andrew I don't know. Yeah. Could you put a politician into that category of thinking of them exercising a fatherhood towards everybody under their care, not just a particular segment? It's almost an impossible thing to look to an example of in our 21st century.
But the odd thing about it, and it's beautiful the way you shaped that, how extraordinary it is that people would seek political office
mm-hmm.
in a civil society,
mm-hmm.
which is also struggles to be democratic,
mm-hmm.
and that leaders would not at least have a feel
mm-hmm.
for the fact that once they're elected, they're no longer party pre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is, the party still means something. It's not that it doesn't mean something, mm-hmm. but that once you're elected, you are elevated
mm-hmm.
to consider the whole of the
mm-hmm.
civil family.
Yeah, precisely. So that was something very new to me that, you know, I'll kind of talk about how that shaped politics even more for me. But then the third type of fatherhood was, of course, the domestic father. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in guildship, you have, mm-hmm. you know, the sons with their father working and modeling after them and being with them. And so when he said that, I mean, right away, now that's another beauty of Newman is, you know, we don't just read the Greek philosophers and, you know, the Catholic works, but we also get to read the more secular modern philosophical works. So mm-hmm. reading Friedrich Nietzsche,
mm-hmm.
right, talking about how God is dead and we've killed him. I mean, I connected that to the class with Dr. Topping when we were talking about those three types of fatherhood in the medieval age. And I thought, wow, the brokenness that I talked about that I saw in people in grade 7, mm-hmm. high mm-hmm. school, and mm-hmm. those business people, I mean, the 21st century has murdered God the Father. In the 21st century, right? God the Father is largely dead in so many different places. And we would never think of our politicians, as you mentioned, as exercising this benevolent fatherhood. And then largely for most people through divorce and crazy work weeks that take the father away from the home, you know, the domestic father is also absent and dead. And that's a problem where there's so many social issues that come from that mm-hmm, very, mm-hmm. that very problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say if there's anything from Newman that's given me, you know, some sort of change in my politics, that, and then reading Pope Leo XIII, Rerum Novarum, and talking about the basis of the family, I was like, wow, you know, I appreciate the work that I do in politics, door knocking or phone calling people, but there's nothing more that you can do to contribute to political society than once again reigniting and you know, doing your part to foster virtuous fatherhood in all of the areas that you're in. And that was also an incredible experience at Newman was, you know, having the professors we did. I mean, they taught us amazing things, but a lot of them are also married and have kids. Mm-hmm. And so you're not just learning about concepts like fatherhood and these living examples. And without living examples, it's almost impossible for us as humans to actually take these abstract concepts and incarnate and live them. And that's what made Newman so special for me, was not just learning these things, but having living examples of people who've studied this stuff for a long time, but then also made the transition from studying to actually living and making these things alive in the way that they live their personal lives.
It's one of the reasons that I found at Newman, and this was quite similar to my own experience in undergraduate school in Chicago. In Chicago, the key professors that I had there would, you know, you were welcome to come to their home.
Mm.
You know, the conversation in the classroom went beyond the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
It went into their life patterns that they were living.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that was so striking to me at Newman was to see that several of the professors there, mm-hmm. certainly Dr. Topping, he understood that the learning that takes place in the classroom
mm-hmm.
needs to be textured
mm-hmm.
by those relationships
mm-hmm.
having a right and proper form beyond the classroom, and that involves your daily life
mm-hmm.
and your home. So, yeah, it's interesting how that worked.
Well, yeah, and that was a beautiful thing about it. I mean, it starts, like you said, in the classroom, but it extends from there. And, you know, you're absolutely right. That's a very good point. You saw it, too, in the students who, yeah, upon taking classes at Newman decided, well, you know, myself, I bought a house and started a Catholic men's house because I thought, well, everything in the classroom is amazing. But you know what? Even beyond the classroom, I have an opportunity to try to extend the learning into my domestic house by making a place where Catholic men can live and be around each other 24/7 so that what happens in the classroom, we can continue in the evenings. We can continue on Saturday when we're playing cards or, you know, doing sports somewhere. That we can continue by going together to Mass on Sunday and then coming back afterwards and having like-minded people to do conversation with. And, you know, at Newman, the initiative of students who decided to foster culture and learning outside of the classroom by starting women's houses, men's houses, organizing singing events, you know, all sorts of things, you know, us doing that was largely due to the fact that we had professors who did the same thing that we could look to and say, wow, this is a very beautiful thing. And, you know, we can imitate that and follow through. One of my favorite spiritual books is Imitation of Christ. As a matter of fact, when I was in Mission, BC, it was my first time living away from home and I never had any brothers. And so, you know, I definitely pushed the boundaries for rules for what you could do for pranks or, you know, making noise while studying and different things. And so one of the monks came to me one day and said, Victor, you're not focusing in study hall and you're getting distracted and you're causing disruption. You need this. And he gave me a leather-bound copy of The Imitation of Christ. He said, you need to read that because otherwise like, you're not going to turn out well. And anyways, it's one of my favorite books. And the whole thing about it is imitating Christ. And, you know, why did Christ become incarnate and why did he become human? Because God wanted to give us a human example to work with our human nature, which he baptizes and blesses, so that we in our human nature can reflect the divine and indeed be the divine. And so, you know.
So some people, Victor,
mm-hmm.
I think, would perhaps appreciate this, but there might be another matter that arises. And let me just ask you a little bit about this. Jesus Christ, as he walked the Valley of the Galilee, the streets of Jerusalem,
mm-hmm.
in those revelatory narratives, one of the most extraordinary things about it is how he is so often encountering the other.
Mm-hmm.
That is, he's bridge building all the time.
Mm-hmm.
He's moving across the boundaries that are the normative boundaries within the society.
Mm-hmm.
And Judaism, one of the great extraordinary gifts of Judaism is its very profound understanding of the tight-knitness of the community.
Mm-hmm.
The wonderful way in which, you know, I've spent a lot of time in the Jewish community, and I've always marveled at the fact that on Shabbat Eve, on Saturday night, in Jewish homes, it's very, very common, even in the busyness of our world,
mm-hmm.
and even if people have very high-profile jobs, they actually set aside time so that they arrive home before mm-hmm. sunset,
mm-hmm.
and the bread has been baked or purchased at, you know, a particular Jewish bakery.
Yeah.
And the table is set.
Mm.
The Havdalah is there.
Mm-hmm.
The blessing of the wine and the bread occurs.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in Jewish families which don't particularly believe in God.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens, which is so striking to me, the mother or the father
mm-hmm.
will walk around the table,
mm-hmm.
place their hands on the head of their children,
mm-hmm.
and they will pray the great benediction, may God, may Adonai bless you and keep you.
Mm.
May Adonai make his face to shine upon you
mm-hmm.
and give you his peace.
Mm-hmm.
I have been in Jewish homes where the parents were atheists,
mm-hmm.
but where they did that.
Wow.
Why? Because atheism is an abstraction.
Mm.
The whole point of it
mm-hmm.
is the wonder of the being of the human.
Mm.
I mean, this is central to the the teaching about the incarnation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what Jesus Christ does is he's restoring the human nature
mm-hmm.
to what it is
mm-hmm.
and what it forgot it was.
Mm.
So that kind of profound domestic, and I use the word respectfully,
mm-hmm.
domestic reality.
Mm-hmm.
When I read the Gospels, because Jesus grew up in that home.
Yeah.
That's the home he grew up in. He was blessed that way all the time around the table. One of the challenges of that is assuming that reality is meant to be that. That the, you know, we can become romantically attached to the domestic church.
Yeah.
Is the way I might put it, whether it be in the home or the parish or what have you.
Yeah.
At least as I read the Gospels, the point of all that is that that is, that gives you a capacity. And that capacity reaches beyond that.
Yeah.
That capacity is meant to make you able, like Abraham and Sarah, to see the stranger and to rush to them and say, please don't pass by.
Yeah.
Please don't pass by. Let me bring you milk and meat. It's pre-kashrut. Let me wash your feet.
Yeah.
Linger. Please linger. So the place of the stranger, you know, in my part of the Christian tradition, we have a rich way of speaking about how our salvation is dependent upon the other. The other is the holy other, God. But also the other is the person we do not know. The person who we may have even assumed was maybe even an enemy. And one of my, one of the things that is so striking to me about the gospel revelation is the way in which it teaches us that we have no enemies. Because everybody is the image and likeness of God. Or at least the image of God, whether they know they're the likeness or not. They're the image of God in their nature. And so this, I mean, part of what I see in what you're saying and establishing your own house for men and talking with Dr. Topping about his sense of the need to do this sort of thing and to build this kind of thing. Also the sense about fatherhood and the significance of fatherhood in our society where these images are so, so shattered. I wonder if there is a temptation to try and find a silo where that exists. But where that will be one step short of its meaning. Because its meaning is to make it possible for us. You know, all of what you've spoken to me sort of exemplifies this in your own life. To reach out to the other. Makes it possible for us to reach out to the other. And when I think of the monastic world, you're reading Dom John Leclerc's book on the love of learning and the desire for God on monasticism in the early centuries. One of the things that's so striking about the monastic world in a time when Europe was really disintegrating, you can say that they withdrew, or I'd like to use the old ancient English word, they conied. They went into a kind of rabbit hole in order to cultivate, not to preserve something, but to give them a capacity to meet the stranger.
Yeah.
And as you've said, or at least you've spoken about in your own discernment process, realizing that it's not good enough to have something for yourself. What's given in the Christian revelation, if it can be truly taken on board, and if it can shape us, it is for the life of the world. It's for the other.
Yeah.
Whether that other is, whatever that other person believes, or however they behave, or whatever party or ideology they belong to, it's that capacity to see in them what God sees in them.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's Anne Lamott, the American writer, who has this charming little phrase where she says that if you discover that your enemy, and she's thinking largely about politics here, I suppose, that your enemy is also God's enemy, then you've created God in your own image.
Wow. Yeah.
So that kind of shifts or puts a different accent on, or a sense of telos, a sense of what the purpose of this is.
Yeah.
So my sense is that the purpose of the monastic life, when it was healthy, was always to be able to serve God's world.
Yeah.
Because God loves the world.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that's what you said here really providentially ties into this year is the Jubilee Year of Hope. Because to hope is to suffer well.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is, I was talking with a friend about this, you know, about 2.5 months ago, how, you know, when we go through Newman and you get the privilege, the gift and the blessing of, you know, getting to drink deeply from the great books and, you know, the lives of the saints and the church fathers, your imagination is captivated and inspired by the three transcendentals of truth, beauty, and goodness.
Right, yeah.
And one of the things that I think every Catholic has to reckon with, and yeah, any human being who has a deep encounter with truth, beauty, and goodness, is your imagination becomes captivated by these three things that are integral to, you know, who God is. And, you know, your imagination, you know, delights in truth, beauty, and goodness. And then you have to live with the reality, as you said, right? You know, contending with the fact that reality is not always, you know, the ideals of truth, beauty, and goodness perfectly incarnated. It never is. But
well, it isn't in me.
Yes.
So why should I assume it should be in others?
Yeah. You know, but it is.
And God's mercy has come to me, and I know that.
Yeah.
I don't really know God's justice, but I know God's mercy because it's been expressed to me.
Mm.
So perhaps I should extend that.
Yes, yeah, precisely. And, you know, we do see truth, beauty, and goodness incarnate in the person of Christ. And so so part of the things when you say of, you know, sharing with other people is we have a recognition that, you know, even though we know what the ideals are and our imagination can be completely subscribed to those ideals, it's our lifelong process of conversion and journey to try to allow Christ to be incarnate inside of us so that those ideals can truly live and flourish. But nonetheless, that's one of the things you take away is, you know, you have to be hopeful and learn how to suffer well and to almost carry the burden of experiencing so much truth, beauty, and goodness, but carry the burden knowing that for the rest of your life, it's going to be an ongoing journey to try to live that in reality and that it is possible to incarnate it. It's just, that's what the saints did.
But that occurs existentially in every encounter in our life. That's where it happens, in those encounters. It's not an abstraction.
Yeah. Ah, I see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. No, that's a good
lovely insight.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Goh. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us. I expect you will hear Victor's name in the future as he takes his place in the political life of Canada. He may be a bellwether for a new political discourse, one rooted in seeking friendship despite difference, caring for the civil community large enough for all, in which a concern for all that is good, true, and beautiful seeps into the dry desert of what is current. I welcome your comments on the various themes in this podcast and invite you to visit our website. Contact details may be found in the program notes.